Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. There's not that much cricket to talk about this week, but there's plenty of other stuff to talk about related to cricket. We've got the rain-affected latest round of the county championship, a bit of international cricket, but most interestingly, with the England-New Zealand series not that far away, we'll be looking back at the Black Caps' visit to these shores in 2015 that featured a thrilling test series and the ODI series with the highest run rate of all time. We've got Sam Billings on the show later to talk about it all. Billings made his England debut that series where England set down the blueprint for their World Cup triumph 4 years down the line. I'm Yaz Ryan, and with me today is former England batsman Mark Butcher, the managing editor of Wisden.com, Ben Gardner, and the magazine editor of Wisden Cricket Monthly, which goes to print either today or tomorrow, Joe Harmon.
Today, in a couple
of hours. Excellent. Are you all done? Or
I'm done. Phil's obviously lagging behind, but yeah.
Excellent. Well, we had been a bit spoilt by how good the championship had been recently. So I think we were due a round where the rain played an irritatingly prominent role in proceedings. But there were still plenty of good cricket and interesting storylines for us to get our teeth stuck into. Joe, let's start with your moment of the week.
Yeah, mine was another stellar performance from Craig Overton, who is fast becoming county cricket's MVP. In fact, I think he is that officially on the PCA's charts. He was the star of the show as Somerset defeated Hampshire by 10 wickets at the Ageas. Took 2 for 16 from 11 overs, then hit 74 from 93 balls, then 5 for 66 from 40 overs. So a pretty epic performance from Overton. And it's kind of just what we're becoming used to over the last couple of years. His numbers are astonishing. So since the start of 2020, 62 wickets at 13.7, 459 runs at 33. So Taha's written a nice little thing for him about him in the Next magazine, saying he's starting to kind of occupy this middle ground where he's a bit too good for county cricket, it seems, at the moment, and really should get an opportunity in test cricket. It's just very hard to see how that's going to happen given their kind of wealth of pace options they've got at the moment.
Yeah, it's worth saying that he's never been this dominant in county cricket before. So when he's played for England, he's had good county numbers, but he's never been this dominant. And also his batting's at a level that's never really been before. I think he averages over 30 with a bat over the last couple of years. The general consensus has been that he's a bit quicker than he was when he played test cricket.
Tom Abel, Somerset's captain, told you, I think, or Ben last year. When you interviewed him. And that's certainly what I've seen on the stream, suggests he is bowling quicker. I'd be amazed if he doesn't go to Australia this winter. It's just whether they can get in some test cricket before then. The interesting thing about him, I think he's a bit different to some of the other bowlers that England have got. I spoke to Steve Kirby, who's Somerset's fast bowling coach, who said Overton, the more he bowls, the better he bowls. So a lot of these quicks like Ollie Stone, Mark Wood, they kind of need to be wrapped in cotton wool. You kind of bring them out for maybe one or two games a series. Overton seems to just be a player that just kind of needs those overs to keep going and gets better and better as he does. So that's quite a useful thing to have, especially in a potentially quite grueling Ashes tour. Also, he bats. A lot of these bowlers, a lot of these quicks don't bat especially well. Overton, based on current form, could actually be a test number 8 at a push, certainly a very good number 9. So he's got quite a lot going for him. It's just whether he can, first of all, get ahead of Ollie Robinson in the queue and then leapfrog some of the kind of the existing pace options who are going to be hard to budge because they're all bloody good bowlers.
Yeah, Robinson's, I guess, the name that's not been around for as long, but Overton's actually younger than Robinson. I mean, just, he's been around the England setup, the periphery of it for quite a while. Question for all of you, really. Can you remember any other bowlers in the past who've had short little bursts in the England side when they're 23, 24, spent a few years away from the team and then came back and did really well? Obviously, Anderson is the most obvious.
Chris Wokes as well, I guess. Yeah. He took a few goes at it to before that Pakistan series in 2016 when he was sort of just another level. He really struggled in that series in South Africa before that. And I think he sort of might well have thought that was maybe his last go. I think his average was sort of skyrocketing at that point. And then he took 9 for in a game for Warwickshire and then got the call back up and then has kind of not looked back since, especially at home. So he's one, I guess. Any others?
I suppose the thing with Overton as well, that he didn't, it's not like he kind of disgraced himself when he bowled fine. He obviously got Steve Smith out. He batted very bravely, particularly in New Zealand. Did he top score against New Zealand?
Yeah.
Fair enough. Almost held on for a draw in the Ashes as well. So I think he's got a little bit of credit on the bank, even though he looked perhaps a little bit short of test class. So it's not like other bowlers in the past who have got to go, done terribly, and almost been sort of discounted for the reckoning. I think he's always been there or thereabouts. He just looks a better player each year.
Yeah, I mean, but it's interesting that he, you're right, he didn't look overawed when he played Test cricket, but he's also featured in some of English cricket's kind of lowest moments in Test cricket over the last few years, like that 58 all out when he didn't disgrace himself. Again, the Old Trafford Test when we lost the Ashes at home for the first time since, what, 2001?
Not entirely his fault.
No, yeah. Not exactly. Not his fault. And in fact, he did as much as anyone to try and avert that in that game. But
he's suggesting he's some sort of curse on English cricket, the sort of anti-Tim Bresnan.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Or Sam Curran or whatever. Yeah.
But it is interesting. He's played four test matches, all defeats. And the 2019 one was just quite strange. It just kind of took people by surprise when he played for England, because Sam Curran had been in the squad at that point, had a really good 2018. But it was, Overton was picked ahead of him.
Yeah, I wonder, just on what Joe was saying about his batting position, I wonder if England might almost hope he could be a makeshift number seven. I don't know if we want to talk about the test stuff.
It looks like you want to.
Too much. But it's just. I mean, we don't yet know which of those players who've come back from the IPL are going to be available or make themselves available for that. And if Sam Curran and Chris Wokes both choose to sit out, which they've both had pretty tough winters and, you know, haven't seen their families all that much and that sort of thing, Craig Overton is one of the more realistic options to kind of fill that all-rounder slot, I guess. And that average of just above 30 is like, you'd ideally like that to be higher, but he's, you know, played at Taunton where bowlers generally are on top. So I wonder, and he's also, he's getting the kind of those clutch runs as well, I think. Like he's almost quite reliable for Somerset in that when they're five or six down, but he's there, they still kind of feel that they have that hope, I think. And I wonder if that kind of almost that sense for season at the moment will make him hope that he can do that job, even if it's just for two games in this series.
Yeah, seven feels still too high, though, I think, because he doesn't really... He's usually at eight for Somerset, isn't he? I mean, certainly was when he scored. In fact, I think he was even nine because the night watched when he scored his 70. It seems quite a lot to ask a fast bowler who's informed to come into the test side and bat higher than they do for their county. I think England probably might need to pick...
Very 90s.
Yeah, very 90s. Very 90s. He'd be batting at six in that 99 side, wouldn't he?
I mean, well, I haven't got much to say on the subject, really, beyond the fact that bowlers generally, if they come into the side as with, you know, with a bit of a reputation behind them, it's usually injury that sees them miss out for the next 4 or 5 years, as opposed to being picked too soon and discarded. And the other thing is we're reading that England are very likely to have sort of not a scratch squad, but like a second choice team out in the test matches against New Zealand, which I'm horrified by.
Me too.
But I can see why. But I'm horrified by the idea that you would do that with a team as good as, well, the number one team in the world for a start, a team that's going to be fighting for the World Test Championship for second. Yeah, not a good look.
From what Giles has said in the last week or so, it looks like it'll be up to the players who were in the IPL to see if they're going to be available for that series. What's your impression of whether or not they'll actually make themselves available?
Well, I mean, I have sympathy in some ways, but I have none in others. You know, the IPL is what it is for players. They can decide to play in it or not. They also have positions in an England team or caps to win an England team that shouldn't be taken for granted. So I would imagine that there aren't many of the guys coming back from the IPL, particularly given that it's been cut short, that would turn around and say, actually, you know, I'm not going to play for England in test matches against New Zealand. I'd be horrified by that, honestly.
I was thinking more from like a welfare point of view. No, these guys had long winters, etc.
But that everybody's in the same boat, really. As I've said, choosing to go to the IPL, even though the team Owen Morgan and the selectors are very keen for the players to go to the IPL because of the World T20 coming up. I understand all of that stuff. But then to turn around and say, you know what, I'm going to sit out of the test matches if selected because of the IPL, which didn't even finish, that's wrong.
I'd be amazed if Chris Wokes, for example, I'm sure he's desperate to play in that first test.
He's hardly played any cricket.
Yeah, Phil's just interviewed for Upcoming Magazine. He was in, I think as he talks about, he was in India not enjoying life. He's back. I think the prop decision might well be taken out of his hands, though, because there'll be other bowlers who have, someone like Robinson, someone like Overton, who have been taking wickets in county cricket, who this is an opportunity to give them a go. So it's different. I think there's a difference between saying we're picking some second string players to this is the best side to pick for this certain game. And I'm absolutely on board with the latter. And if that means giving someone like Ollie Robinson a debut, then great. But just mixing up for the sort of sake of mixing it up and worrying about workloads and stuff. I'm
no, and there is, you know, there is the small matter of an Ashes tour to think about.
I think the Ashes tour bit is relevant. So I basically agree with both of what you said. Mm. But Ben, you were quite persuasive when you were kind of the other day when you explained to me that Ollie Robinson or Craig Overton, there is a more obvious way into the 11 in a five-match Ashes series where there's lots going on, where their style of bowling might be more favourable than some other players in the England camp. But you want them to have played Test cricket before then?
Yeah, I think so. So I can see a real argument for England basically looking at the nine bowlers, I think we counted, that they've got.
Pace bowlers who could
sort of do a job in Test cricket, and looking at them as a group from now on, basically until the end of that Ashes, and say maybe you sort of have a few of different types and you're obviously monitoring people's fitness, but kind of saying we want all these guys, we think all these guys are going to play a part, so let's not wait until someone breaks down or is really showing signs of fatigue, but just rest and rotate as we go. And I mean, I know we don't know how good Overton will be in Test cricket and how much he's actually improved and what that will translate to, and we don't know how good Robinson is, but from what the judges say and that sort of thing, they seem like they'll do a pretty capable job. So I can see the argument for sort of just mixing and matching kind of from now, essentially. But the one thing I do think is that I wonder if England now look back at last summer and wonder if that was a slight missed opportunity, because I completely agree that England shouldn't take this New Zealand challenge lightly. And if they're not careful, they'll go into the Ashes having lost their last three Test series because of how good New Zealand are and how good India are. And if they don't take them seriously, then that could well happen. But I also understand the motivation to want the likes of Ollie Robinson to play, to make his debut, James Bracey as well, possibly, and Craig Overton. And it feels like last summer against two weaker teams in sort of some slightly less high profile games, that was the chance to give those guys a go.
You say that though, but Mark Wood played one Test match all summer. You know, there were bowlers who would reasonably expect to go, well, would definitely expect to go on the Ashes tour, who didn't get a game in those circumstances. So if you start off from the position whereby you're picking a team that you're always going to end up with one, maybe one debutant or something like that. One member of the bowling lineup is perhaps new, but to do it wholesale because you're trying to give people a go whilst resting, you know, players who would be first choice. Chris Wokes, again, we'll go back to him. He hasn't played a Test match since Pakistan last summer. You know, those guys aren't going to want to sit out. Mm-hmm. So if you know, it's a bit of a cop out to say we're going to leave it up to the players to decide. It's either your policy that this is what you want to do. Again, going back to our selection sort of talk and who's in charge of selection and who, you know, the fact that there is now no separate entity in charge of selection. You either say this is our policy and we're going to be resting you players, and that is we'll take that on, that's our decision, or you play the best team that you can pick. Putting it on the players to say we you know, if you feel like you want to have a rest, and sort of passing the buck in terms of whose responsibility that decision is, I don't like that either. Mm. I'm not liking very much already this week.
Well,
should we move on?
well, I think next week...
We've done one about not speaking about England's Test squad, haven't we?
Well, next week, by the time we record, England will probably have named their Test squad, so we can talk about it all again next week. Ben, elsewhere with that Somerset team, obviously we talked about their bowling, but a couple of batsmen doing right at the moment, and you're interested in two of them, Tom Abel and Stephen Davies.
Yeah, well, Stephen Davies especially, just a really interesting story throughout his career, really. Obviously, started out as this kind of white ball dasher and got his go in England doing that. I think, what were you saying is his ODI numbers were? He's averaging...
Well, he averages 30, but his strike rate was over 100, which for the 2009-2010 England side was revolutionary.
Yeah, and he sort of changed himself. I was just speaking to Jason Kerr, the Somerset coach, who's saying that he's kind of, his white ball stuff is sort of possibly cycling in decline, but he's actually just improved as a red ball batsman kind of since he's moved to Somerset and is now kind of just one of their most reliable. But the one that really interests me from a current point of view is Tom Abel, who is obviously had an interesting career at Somerset, got the captaincy really young, even in a side with some really established players, and then dropped himself halfway through his first season because of his poor form, and has since become kind of pretty much their most reliable player, I guess. This season he's their top run scorer, and he's one of those that his numbers often don't leak on the page because he doesn't get these huge scores. Like, I think this season he's the guy with the most runs in county cricket without 100, which is very typical of him. He wasn't in England's 55-man training group last year, despite having been on that Lions tour. So it's kind of almost hard to see what England think of him, where they see he's at. But I think he's one of those, when you see him play, he makes tough runs. He makes runs at the right time. And he also seems like he can do both, sort of the playing of pace and spin, which you have to do if you're at Taunton when both are really in the game. So, he's quite exciting. I'm interested to see how the rest of the year goes for him.
And Somerset, do you reckon this is their year, Joe?
Well, no, I've said it won't be. Kind of hoping that it will be. But they're going all right. They had that blip, didn't they? Lost to Gloucestershire, but yeah. Two wins since then. So they're going nicely.
Yeah, and on Gloucester, there's a very good win for them on live on Sky. Ben, you were there for some of it. They're looking pretty good at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about James Bracey enough, but I think that might be my first time seeing him bat. Or must be my first time seeing him bat live. And he was excellent. Made a very nice 75 and then took a good catch. And yeah, they kind of seem like they've got it all covered. And they've now got that winning habit. And it's... it's just reward for that 2019 season when they won promotion, which ended up not counting.
Being a promotion.
Yes. But it's good that's the building blocks of this success now. And yeah, there's a really big game that will be coming up between Gloucester and Somerset, because they look like the two front runners for that group. And the top two that go through take some points through as well. So with Gloucester having already got the bragging rights with the win at Taunton, there'll be a... sort of quite a lot riding on that, I think.
Mm. David Payne had a really good game, mm-hmm. taking a temper in that. And they just have a bowling attack, which is not the most exciting to watch because they all bowl quite similar speeds and just keep it quite simple, but doing the job at the moment.
Yeah, and Dan Worrell there overseas, he looks almost like the weakest member of that attack, which is, I think, quite a sign of the attack's overall strength. Found out an interesting thing about Dan Worrell this week.
Go on.
About a ban he got when he was playing in Australian cricket in either 2013 or 2014 for scratching... Are we allowed to say that word on this? Yeah.
Yeah.
For scratching a penis into the pitch with his spikes.
Right.
So it's quite good for artwork.
The word
done
scratching wasn't the
boots.
One you were worried about.
You can definitely say penis on a podcast.
Okay, good.
That's
my interesting fact about Dan Worrell.
Wonderful. Elsewhere, Notts won their second game on the bounce, this time against defending champions Essex. Northants beat Sussex by an innings, where Ben Sanderson and Gareth Berg took 19 of the 20 Sussex wickets to fall. They looked like they could get all 20
at one
point.
That would have been a world record, wouldn't it?
Very rarely. I think the last time it happened was 15 years ago. Panesar and somebody else at Northants
took all 20.
Yeah,
between
took all
20. Wow. So it was the 20th wicket that went
down. Yeah,
and
it was Tom Taylor ruined the fun by getting the last wicket. Taha has spoken to Berg in the last couple of days, and quite interesting. Berg is the player head coach of Italy at the moment.
He is.
Which is quite interesting. Mm. Can't be many player head coaches in international cricket.
No, he's a proper survivor as well, because Middlesex let him go several years ago, saying that he basically wasn't fit enough for them to give him a contract. And he's obviously still going strong.
He's 40.
Yeah. Mm. Playing international cricket, domestic cricket, cleaning up.
Absolutely. There was quite a funny photo of the two of them holding the match ball off the first innings. And I think that Sanderson and Berg look like what you'd expect Joe Root and Mark Wood to look like in 5-10 years' time.
It was more of a visual joke. It works very well. Go look at Yaz's tweet. Did that go viral?
Half viral. We'll try and put it up on the YouTube video for people to see. let's go to international cricket. Pakistan beat Zimbabwe by an innings and 147 runs to take that series 2-0. The double ton for Abid Ali, a century for Azhar Ali, and lots of wickets for Hassan Ali, who is the leading wicket taker in the world in 2021 in both Tests and T20Is. He averages just 22 in Test cricket, which, mm-hmm. you know, he burst on the scene 4 or 5 years ago as a predominantly white ball bowler, but he's had
an amazing Champions Trophy, didn't he? That's where he kind of made his name, and then faded strangely because he looked like he was going to be a proper world beater at that
stage.
And I think he had a really, really good season in first class cricket, and now and his batting's improved as well. He didn't get any runs, but he was batting 7 in the second Test. One thing that's quite interesting is Pakistan gave a debut to 36-year-old seamer Tabish Khan. So one to keep an eye on.
Got to be 36 or 17, basically. Yeah, nothing in the middle.
Yeah.
Did he take his 600th first class wicket in the game?
No, I think he's on 599.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Sorry.
Nearly. There was quite a tedious debate after the game about whether Zimbabwe should be allowed to play Test cricket. Ramesh Raja said, "I hope they do well in the future, but for now, they should not play Test cricket and concentrate only on white ball cricket." I'm not sure how
he expects them to do well in the future. They don't play test cricket. And there's a couple of interesting stats to put that in their defeat in perspective. Both of Pakistan's wins this series were by smaller margins than their defeat in the second test of their tour of New Zealand this year. Pakistan have also lost all of their last 14 tests in Australia, three of the last four by an innings. And I haven't heard that many people say that Pakistan shouldn't play test cricket in Australia. Anyone wants to add on that? Or
well, Ben covered this very well in his kind of typically acerbic column for the magazine. Is it the kind of lovely, cheery man you hear on this podcast is much spikier in print in the magazine. But yeah, I mean, obviously, it's just mind-numbingly stupid to say we won't play them. And then when you do play them and they're not quite what you expect in terms of standard, then you say, oh, we shouldn't be playing them. I mean, it's just so frustrating.
Mm. I think Zimbabwe also won their fourth most recent test against Pakistan, but that was 7 or 8 years ago. So it's a...
Yeah, and they also won the T20i
in this
a couple
series,
of weeks ago. Yeah. I think...
It's not helpful. Mm. It isn't helpful. I mean, you know, on the one hand, you're trying to... You want test match cricket to thrive and to enthrall people in the way that it does us. And you know, one of the damaging parts of that is when you have mismatches. But those mismatches come between established teams and teams that are not established. And really, the only it's finance that really sort of talks in these circumstances. And whereby, if teams like Australia can get away with never playing against Bangladesh, you know, those sort of things hurt the game. But the reason that it happens and the reason that it is allowed to happen and the reason teams aren't keen to host Zimbabwe is because you put three test matches worth of your summer schedule on a team that is not a big draw card and it hurts you financially. Again, there is an answer to this, and that is that the ICC sort of makes sure that there are subsidies in place for all international cricket. Obviously, some nations don't need it, but you have to do it. If you do it for one, you do it for everybody, to make sure that it is not more or less lucrative to dodge playing teams like that. In the same way as I would have, a minimum wage for players on test match playing test matches, so that the decision to not play for your country becomes a financially viable one. Think West Indies, think other teams that lose players that go off and play franchise cricket instead of playing for their country. All of these things can be taken care of by the centre with a bit of will. And you do that and you make it so that it is absolutely imperative that everybody gets to play everybody and everybody gets their experience, and hopefully you have less mismatches. Mm. And the game spreads, and that's in everybody's interest.
The IC, I think, have almost tried to force more games between countries that don't normally play each other in the World Test Championship, and more obviously in the ODI Super League. I don't think you'd ever see, without something like that, an England three-match series scheduled against the Netherlands without something like that. So I think that's...
No, but it has to happen. It has to happen for the longer form of the game as well. It has to. Either that or, you only three teams play it and then the whole thing eats itself anyway. So there has to be a solution. It's not good enough. It isn't good enough just for everyone to say, isn't it a little bit jolly that Australia haven't played in Bangladesh for the last 10 years? Or, Ramiz has got a point about Zimbabwe. Do something about it. Do something.
Elsewhere in the international game, BJ Watling has announced that he will retire from all forms of cricket at the end of New Zealand's tour of England, which includes the Test Series against England and the World Test Championship final. This century, only two wicketkeeper batsmen have scored more Test runs at a higher average than Watling, Gilchrist and Pryor. Joe, just a very good player in a team that's doing very well at the moment, has done for a long time.
Yeah, hugely reliable. I think his keeping has been really good, one of the best in the world for his keeping alone. And then you've got the batting on top of that, which was, I think we picked our Test Team of the Year for 2019, would it have been, that he was the keeper in that. And he's kind of your classic Kiwi Test cricketer, quite understated. And you look at his record and you think, wow, what a player. They're fortunate they've got Tom Blundell coming through. He's kind of already been part of that setup. So that, again, what New Zealand seem to do quite well is line-up replacements for players before they go. And that looks like a kind of quite smooth transition, all being well. But no doubt he'll be missed. And it will be, I really hope he can get some runs here this summer and kind of finish off in style.
He is a guy that you ask your bowlers who the sort of player, the sort of batsman that you love, and he is that. You know, they get to put their feet up, get a massage, maybe have another one. They know they're not going to be bowling again the next morning. You know, they are, and then by the time comes to make that declaration, they are ready to go second innings of games. They absolutely, bowlers love players like BJ Watling.
And they must hate bowling against him as well. Yeah. You get five wickets and BJ Watling comes in. You know, that's pretty demoralising.
No, pretty tough. I mean, he's been a wonderful, wonderful player.
Yeah, I was looking at his stats as a keeper for New Zealand. He's got the most runs, the best average, most hundreds, most dismissals. So he's kind of out in front basically in all departments as a wicketkeeper for New Zealand in Test cricket. I think we're probably going to talk about him more because of the 2015 series, I guess, when he had a defining impact on. But there were two... Do you remember he played a part in two world record stands for the sixth wicket in Test cricket less than a year apart at the same ground? First accompanying Brendan McCullum in when he made his triple hundred, which rescued New Zealand from like an absolutely hopeless position against India. I think they were over 150 behind and five wickets down when Watling came in and ended up saving that game, which isn't something that should be possible, really. And then again, the next year...
They unveiled a plaque
to
commemorate it.
And then he broke it in that very same game, when Kane Williamson made a double hundred. And again, they were effectively 27 for five, I think, against Sri Lanka. And he made a big hundred again. They ended up winning that game. So yeah, he's one of those that's also done it in the tough situations as well. He's not at all your traditional wicketkeeper batsman in terms of the swashbuckling sort of thing. He just comes in and plays kind of like a proper batsman, but also just plays absolutely normally, I guess, all the way through. And that's what marks him out.
Mm. Back in the UK, the England women's A side beat the England women's side in a warm-up game at Loughborough. Lauren Winfield-Hill scored an unbeaten 140 to help the A side chase down 270 with nearly five overs to spare. Some other good performances for the A side. A half century for George Adams opening the batting and a threefer for Mandy Villiers, who has obviously played for England. But that's good to see. The two teams, there are a lot of players in the A team who've played quite a lot of international cricket. So,
well, I think that's brilliant because, I mean, we covered the final of the domestic 50-over competition last year. And obviously England's series against the West Indies at the back end on Sky. Freezing cold. Oh, it's in Derby. And the feeling has been, you know, I've done quite a bit of stuff with the England women over the last 4 or 5 years. And the feeling has been a little bit that whilst... highly professional, very, very good team. There has been very next to no players breaking in from underneath. That the depth perhaps wasn't quite strong enough to knock Australia off their perch, and also that the England selectors and the coaching staff and the hierarchy were not all that keen on sort of breaking up the established order there. So that's really good. Really great that they've kind of, you know, thrown a bit of it. I mean, Lauren Winfield-Hill has been around forever, you know, sort of as a squad player for them. But somebody like Georgia Adams, who was by far and away the leading run scorer in the comp last year, might have found it very difficult to break in, but for something like this. So, you know, it's keeping them all on their toes anyway.
Absolutely. Some fun chat about cricket bats. So a study by the University of Cambridge has suggested that cricket bats made of bamboo offer a more sustainable alternative to ones made of willow. Darshil Shah, one of the researchers behind the study, said that bamboo bats are stiffer, harder and stronger, although more brittle. In the Guardian report on the story, they say it takes about 15 years before a willow tree can be harvested, after which new trees must be planted. Between 15 and 30% of the wood is also wasted during bat production. Bamboo is cheaper, plentiful, fast growing and sustainable. Shoots are available to grow from previous stumps and maturity is reached after 7 years. But the serious point on this is that in countries where cricket isn't big, it is genuinely quite difficult to produce lots of bats. And so that was an interesting article. Then the MCC got involved the next day and they released a statement on the use of bamboo bats. And they said, currently, law 5.3.2 states that the blade of the bat must consist solely of wood. So for bamboo, which is a grass, to be considered as a realistic alternative to willow would require a law change.
A law change.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Would you, how would you go about
doing one of those?
But,
I mean,
but Ben, that's the laws taking care of every eventuality.
Or, as they always do. As they always do.
Ben once spoke for about 5 minutes on the pod about how much he loves. What was you gave one ridiculous line about how much you love the laws.
I can't remember.
I think it was more than 5 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, another interesting thing about that is that I've sort of gone into bat, forgive me, for defending sort of bat manufacturers and defending players, actually. Because God knows, I mean, how boring it is to hear fellow commentators, to writers, to have, you know, the general public have this idea that somehow the reason that players are able to score at the rates that they score is down to bats more than anything else, which is complete and utter nonsense. You know, it's as a, you know, because every time a team gets bowled out for 100, they haven't taken out the wrong bat, have they? You know, it's not, it's the players and it's their conditioning and it's their the practice regimes that, you know, that have them scoring at rates that were unthinkable 20 years ago. And so that the idea of a bamboo bat is interesting to me simply because it highlights the fact that the equipment that people are using is still made out of exactly the same substances as Jack Hobbs was using or W.G. Grace was using all those years ago. It's still willow held together by glue, twine, cane for the handle. You know, what you haven't seen in cricket, yes, they've managed to work out different ways of distributing the wood and pressing techniques and all this kind of stuff. But a cricket bat is still made out of the same stuff that it was made out of 100 years ago. Whereas in all the other sports, whether you're talking motorsport, whether you're talking running shoes, whether you're talking golf clubs, tennis rackets, all of the technology has actually very much changed the performance of these pieces of equipment. And cricket is by and large exactly the same. The players are very different, but the stuff is still the same. There you go. That's a bit boring stuff for you.
It is interesting. But yeah, I think the other serious point is just that in countries like Brazil or China, Japan, getting into cricket, they just don't have a production line of bats. And if there is a quicker way of bringing bats through, then got to be all for it.
If you imagine the hoo-ha that there has been around something that hasn't changed at all, right? But as I've said, bats are still exactly the same. Imagine the amount of testing and hand wringing there is going to be if suddenly they're made out of a different material. Oh my God!
Yeah, I mean, I just wouldn't be surprised if there was a law change. Basically, that was all the same. One thing was acknowledging that the current laws. Yeah, but you know, these laws do change. They're not as fixed as it can seem when you call them a law like that. So,
What's your moment of the week, Ben?
Oh, my moment of the week is the publishing of the first of a six-part series written by Scott Oliver, one of our freelancers. It's maybe his life's work on Adrian Shankar, who made his so he signed for Worcestershire 10 years ago on the Monday just gone, and was released, I think, about 17 days later when they found out that details about tournaments that he claimed to have played in and his date of birth had been fabricated. So that was already an interesting story, but it goes far, far beyond that when you see the scale of. So there were sort of websites created that said that he'd been, you know, hugely successful in this Sri Lankan, it's the Mercantile T20 tournament is what it was called. The games had just like never happened. He claimed that he'd hit Rangan Harath for 5 sixes and over, maybe 6 sixes was too sort of unrealistic, and that had never happened. There was one line in the piece from Luke Sutton, who was writing in the Daily Mail back at the time, who was at Lancashire, where Shankar had spent a stint as a second-level cricketer. So we said that Shankar wasn't a totally hopeless cricketer. He made a century for the Cambridge varsity team when he was there, did some okay stuff in club cricket, and, you know, played some second-level without entirely disgracing himself, although you wouldn't have said he stood out by any means. But when he was at Lancashire, the subject of him being 3 years older than he actually said came up, and Luke Sutton asked him about it, and Shankar said that he was he spent the first three years of his life in a coma and on life support, and that's why he was physically 3 years younger than his age suggested he should be. And then Sutton said, surely you grew during that time, and he said that Shankar looked him dead in the eye and said, no, I didn't, and then walked off. Yeah, like there's so much good stuff in there. It's really long, and the whole series is really long. But I promise you, it's worth.
It is worth it.
And do we know what he's up to now, or is that all to come?
To be fine.
Don't want to give too much away.
Okay.
But Scott will be with us on the show next week for a little bit. Talk through the Shankar files.
I'm glad this has come to fruition, because Scott has been talking about this for about as long as I've known him, which is getting on for about as long as Adrian Shankar has been around as a pretend cricketer.
Yeah.
So I'm glad it's got there.
Well, yeah. and that's one of the things is that a lot of people have been saying, like, this needs to be made into a film. I think the thing is the film couldn't be complete without a character playing Scott, you know, the journalist who's been on the case.
Well, that's the story, really. Adrian Shankar is just the kind of support character. It's Scott's life work.
So we'll hopefully have Scott on next week's show. On to the 2015 England New Zealand series. Why are we doing this? So
basically, why are we doing this?
Well, so New Zealand are obviously coming to England very, very soon, and like we did a couple of weeks ago, we looked back at the 99 series that Butcher's part of. We're looking back at one of the more entertaining visits from New Zealand to the UK. So first off, I'm going to set the scene, take us back to 2015. The test series was England's first after the sacking of Peter Moores following England's disappointing World Cup campaign and their drawn test series in the Caribbean. Assistant coach Paul Farbrace took charge of that series. It was announced in between the first two test matches that Trevor Bayliss would take over for the Ashes series that followed. And on the whole, it hadn't been a great couple of years for England. Still in the shadow of the 2013-14 Ashes, they lost a home series against Sri Lanka in 2014, beat India at home in 2014, which is obviously a good result. But then they had that miserable World Cup campaign in 2015. Is it fair to say that was England's lowest point since the 99 series?
Feels like it.
Well, there was quite a bad Ashes series in there somewhere, wasn't there? Away from home.
I suppose there were always bad Ashes series. Well, not always, but
What was their timescale for worstness?
Well, an 18-month period.
Well, there we go.
it's tough. I feel like if you had to pick an actual moment, it might have been after that Lord's Test against India in 2014, which England lost to go 1-0 down. And at that point, they'd, I think, lost to the last three tests against Sri Lanka and India, and it looked like they might lose that series against India as well, lose both home series with a team that should be beating these teams comfortably. And then they bounced back from that, and then you had, I mean, there's quite a lot of low points, even now we get a few every now and then. But
In terms of ODI cricket though, that World Cup, I mean, you just described it as disappointing. I think that is generous. I mean, it couldn't have gone more wrong, really. I mean, out of the earliest opportunity, and some of the beatings they got were humiliating as well. And it's similar to 99 in terms of what happened in Test cricket that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. It was reaching rock bottom in order to be able to kind of bounce back up from that and put new things in place.
Mm. Yeah.
We don't want to talk about the 2015 World Cup, but they didn't lay a glove on any of those three sort of... Because in each group, you had four teams you'd expect to go through. And I think it was Sri Lanka, New Zealand, Australia, and England were absolutely hammered by all three of them. And then obviously beaten by Bangladesh as well.
Mm.
So yeah, grim tournament.
And then from the test point of view, we'll get onto the ODI series. We've got the chat with Billings, who's very good on that. But before the test series, it's quite interesting that Ben Stokes, before that series, had never scored a test run in England. So he'd only played a couple of home tests against India, where he was batting at 8 or 9, and he got 3 ducks in his 3 innings. That 2 test series also saw the debuts of Adam Lyth and Mark Wood. And Ben, there were just 2 brilliant test matches.
Yeah, they were. Do you want me to give the story of them?
Go on.
Okay, so the first game, England were 4 down for not many before lunch, I think, on the first day. And then Root and Stokes sort of did one of those Roots and Stokes partnership where Root is really busy, Stokes pretty belligerent. They both hit 90s, I think, and then got out. So England made 300-ish, and then Kane Williams made a brilliant 100. England got a huge lead. So I think that even, you know, with how well England had done to sort of get up to where they were going to lose heavily. And then Cook played what really is actually one of his best.
Please, sir, the Kane Williamson innings was absolute filth. It was just porn for batting. It really was just beautiful late playing and glides down to third man, extra coverage. Right, it was just leaves. I mean, all of it was just sex as far as batting was concerned. Sorry, carry on.
I wasn't sure which way you were going to go when you said it was absolute filth.
No, it was, you know, there was, I remember there being lavish movement. It was a greenish deck. It did all sorts. And he just played it on his nana. Sorry, carry on.
Just a lovely description. And probably was in stark contrast to Cook's innings, which was in really tough conditions. And he kind of ground out one of his best hundreds for England, really, considering the match situation and the quality of that attack. So he kind of laid the bedrock. And then Stokes scored the fastest 100 by an Englishman at Lord's and was, I guess, his second great test innings at that point. And he's very few of his hundreds you would count as not being properly great, I think, still. And then England, from having been way behind the game, managed to scrape together like enough of a lead to sort of try and get New Zealand all out on the next day. Stokes took two wickets in an over, I think.
Williamson and McCullum.
And then Mo and Ali took a brilliant catch sort of in front of a packed house crowd down at third man to win it. And it was just like that final, I mean, the whole test was brilliant, but that final day just felt kind of like raucous and exciting and kind of new in a way that like English cricket as a whole hadn't felt for quite a long time. And then the second game
the highest run aggregate for a test match at Lord's?
That sounds
1600 runs or something.
Because it went quite deep.
It was certainly a massive amount of runs. Because when I was looking back through it, I was thinking, how the heck did anybody win this game, given that there were that many runs scored? But yeah, hell of a match.
Mm.
And then the next game, I think possibly the first day was washed out to rain. So it was effectively a 4-day test. So New Zealand, in their New Zealand style, were like, we've just got to go for ball one at this. BJ Watling had a small injury. So Luke Ronke came in, sort of smashed a 70-odd. McCullum hit his first ball for 6, I think. And so then they racked up 350, but could have got a lot more if they'd been trying to. But they thought, let's kind of get that as quickly as we can. England then had a brilliant opening stand where Lyth got his 100. Got to 350 exactly the same as well. And so then the third innings was a real kind of tense shootout, really. So New Zealand were 4 for 140, I think. And that's when BJ Watling playing as a specialist batsman, even though it was 200 to keep, scored a sort of a really gritty rear guard 100, and New Zealand won that quite easily. So that was a brilliant series. I wonder if how that series went in terms of being reasonably successful for England almost set them back in Test cricket, because they were trying to play a certain style, going kind of pound for pound with New Zealand, where they were like, backing these all-rounders and these sort of exciting young batsmen, and sort of thinking, if we let these players play with freedom and sort of express themselves, one of them's good enough that they'll win us the game. And that happened in the first game with Stokes. But actually what we're now seeing is England going away from that, thinking we've got a game plan, we've got to get big runs, sort of almost more attritional cricket. And if England had sort of received sort of a bit of a setback then, or more of one, where they might have sort of realised that lesson sooner rather than now. But yeah, it was a brilliant series anyway, from an entertainment point of view.
Absolutely.
Sorry, I talked for ages there.
No, that's okay. Well, then we have the ODI series, which I think has got a reasonable claim to be the most entertaining bilateral ODI series ever. The average run rate across the five games was 7.15, which is a world record, which is just ridiculous.
It's the bats.
Yeah, it's all because of the bats.
Imagine if they were bamboo bats. Yeah.
We're looking early today that the four highest run scoring... the series with the highest run rates in ODI history were all involving England after the 2015 World Cup, which didn't come as a huge surprise. But anyway, that series basically laid the blueprint for what was to come with that England side. And that was the start of their journey to the 2019 World Cup. And we've got a pre-recorded interview with Sam Billings, who goes through it really well. He made his debut that series as a specialist number 7, which is not something you see that often. He talks about how Morgan created an atmosphere where the players felt free and were able to play without pressure. And he also talks about an England Lions tour that came earlier that year, which included Roy, Stokes himself, Vince, Plunkett, Rashid, Wood, and a few others. Here is that conversation with Billings.
Yeah, it was a bit of a kind of fresh outlook on white ball cricket, really, in terms of selection. All the players selected were completely... There were only a few that kind of had the baggage of that World Cup. So it was a real kind of positive opportunity. And for us guys stepping into that, actually, it was kind of nothing to lose, really. So it was a really good place to be. And I mean, Owen Morgan kind of wanted us to go out. He was very, very clear at the start to go out and play an attacking brand of cricket. And it's easy to ban those kind of words around, but then when your captain goes and sets the tone and plays in exactly that manner, I think it was the last ODI chasing, he slog swept his first ball out to deep cow. But actually the knock-on effect of that regardless of the fact he got out, it was the manner in which he got out actually thought gave us all confidence of going, you know what, we can play this attacking way. Because if the captain's doing it, well, yeah, everyone else can do it. And he absolutely backed everyone to do that. In terms of my debut, it was one to forget, really, personally, but it was an amazing game of cricket. I remember I was so nervous. I was so nervous when I got out there. And it was, I think quite a few people, Josh said this to me as well, actually, afterwards. He said, it's kind of get your debut out the way and then you can actually enjoy it after that. And he was right. I think for some people that is the case. For me, it was a matter of actually your whole life's about you kind of build up to that moment, and actually those nerves, it becomes more enjoyable after that first game, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I can imagine. How did Owen Morgan create that environment? Because as you say, it's very easy saying all those things, but how did he actually create it? And specifically for you, batting at seven in white ball cricket is a difficult enough job at the best of times. You have to adapt to difficult conditions. You have to attack from the get-go sometimes. And if you're not established in the team, that can be quite a difficult thing to do when you might think, oh, I need to score some runs, and batting aggressively from the get-go is possibly against that. So how did Morgan make you feel comfortable enough to do that?
Yeah, it's a really good point. I think initially about the outlook of attacking brand of cricket, kind of what I said before about how he set the example gives everyone else the ultimate confidence to do the same. So also the team selection with all the guys around you, we were all very like-minded in the way we go about our cricket, as we are now, and you see the progression that's happened now. But I think that's the key thing, is you've got a group of you who all want to move the game in the right direction, in the same direction. It's very easy for the team to kind of shape their identity around that. If you have kind of course you have different players in the team, but if the general ethos towards the team is all in that manner, that's what's going to happen, kind of thing.
Yeah, I can imagine. But in that first game, you know, you lost Jason Roy first ball of the series. You were 202 for six. What was the chat like in the dressing room when you lose Roy early on? That happens, fair enough. But you were also 202 for six in the first full game after the World Cup with 20 overs to go. And then Butler and Rashid just keep going. England had never played ODI cricket like that before. Was there not a temptation? Did you not think for players to rein it in a little bit? Because, yeah, England supporters have never seen an England team back like that in ODI cricket.
But isn't that a good thing? How many World
Cups? It's a brilliant thing.
No, but I think that's where the huge credit, rightly so, has gone to Owen Morgan the whole time, and Joss as well as vice-captain. Those two guys realised that ODI and 2020 cricket, white ball cricket in this country, had to change. We had the players for it. It's a matter of changing the process of selection and the ethos around that. So again, when it comes from those two, and Joss, that's his natural way of playing, especially in white ball cricket. So you're actually allowing people to play the way they want to play, as opposed to actually putting the brakes on and going. And at times, look, we've realised over the last 5 years that at times when we've had a bit of a collapse and you end up getting bowled out for not as many as you should get, actually, that's when you have a pretty honest conversation and going like, look, we want to play that way, but sometimes the conditions or whatever it is don't allow that, and we have to adjust. We have to be able to adjust. And I think that adjustment is actually changing how we enforce pressure on the different teams. So it's not just about fours and sixes the whole time. Actually, if it's ragging square and their spinners are really bowling well, it might be a matter of working out and scoring at a run a ball. And that puts a huge amount of pressure on them. Joe Root is a great, one of the best at it. So that's just being smart and playing attacking positive cricket. It's still taking the positive option, but having those cricket kind of smarts in there. And I suppose that's what the best teams do in any format of the game. It's combining those two. And that's something that we've done very well over the last 5-6 years, as you've said.
You mentioned Owen Morgan's importance in dictating the way that you guys played. I was wondering, were there any other influences, either maybe Paul Farbrace or maybe the opposition captain or Brendan McCullum, seeing how New Zealand had played and got to that World Cup final and just having them as the first tourists to England after that? Do you think that rubbed off in any way on the England team?
Definitely. I think Morgs has said it a couple of times, actually, that New Zealand team was exactly the way we wanted to play our cricket, really. Them being great mates obviously helps. And it was a perfect storm, really, for everyone. Having, obviously, that World Cup, but then them coming over as the first tourists, as you said. We had to play that way. We had to get up to speed with them. So, yeah, it ended up working out perfectly. And that series was still as good a white ball series as we've probably seen. New Zealand are a phenomenal side. And I think they're actually, they go under the radar way too much. Everyone talks of, obviously, England, Australia and India as the kind of powerhouses. But New Zealand, they're always there and thereabouts. And they go about it. They... their record speaks for itself in recent times. So, like I said, it was just a perfect storm. Morgs and McCullum leading the lines of both teams. What a series that was.
Then on the 2015 World Cup, how much was that mentioned by players or management at the time? I know you rightly said that the personnel changed quite a lot in that series compared to the World Cup, but was that something that Morgan or Farbrace are talking about at all?
I don't think I heard it once. I think maybe at the start, the first kind of team huddle, or when we got to, we met up kind of thing. But I don't remember that at all. It was as if, and like you said, because it didn't directly affect most of us, it just didn't really play on our minds. I suppose with Joss and Owen, there's that added motivation and the experience, the baggage, I suppose, to really turn it around. But for most of us, that's why it was pretty irrelevant, if that makes sense. From a fan point of view, of course, we're all England fans. Of course, we kind of took it on board. But actually, as a player, you're like, well, yeah, it's nothing to do with me. So we've got a free crack at this. And away we go, I suppose.
Mm. And then on a personal level, you had a couple of really important interventions in that series. First in that third game, then crucially in the series finale, where you and Bairstow helped England get back into the game after a bit of a nightmare start in the run chase. How did you feel that the series went for you from a personal point?
Okay. I think I showed glimpses of what I could do without really setting the world alight. And unfortunately, that kind of kept on going, I suppose, for the next couple of years with sporadic opportunity here and there. Batting pretty much every position, 1-7. So without kind of nailing down my spot, I think I was just, if I'm honest, pretty young and naive. And in terms of the success I had for Kent, I mean, it was still probably my best ever year when I averaged over 100 at a strike rate of 160 for Kent batting at 7. And I didn't really know how I did that, if that makes sense. I was just playing and batting as a young player. And I think, you've seen it so much and I've experienced it firsthand now, that as a young player going into the England team or international sport, very few crack it straight away. I mean, Joe Root got dropped, had to go back, reinvent himself, come back. I mean, the list goes on and on. The amount of people that actually do that in terms of a natural progression and journey. So for me, it was kind of an awakening of, okay, yeah, I know I'm good enough at this level, but I'm going to have to, you know, grow up and just work out a few more things, basically. And I suppose without that continuous run of games after that series, it's very hard to learn whilst playing international cricket, if that makes sense. I had to go back and play consistent cricket, and that's something that has obviously hampered my development and maybe kind of made me develop a little bit later than other players, is just the lack of game time, really. I think that's still my only full series of ODI cricket. I think I might be right in saying, so in 6 years, mate, of course, Australia last year, the three match series. But in terms of a five match series, five games in a row, I think that that's the case. So, yeah, look, last year I showed kind of the player I knew I was capable of being, even back then. But actually, I had to change and mature mentally in terms of my approach and yeah, kind of wise up to international cricket, because there is a step up. Of course there is.
Hmm. And then as a team, did that series feel like you were on the start of something special for the next five or so years? England were for the best ODI side in the world. And then, you know, beating the World Cup runners-up in the way you did, did you feel like you were on the start of a special journey?
Well, it's hard to say initially then, but once you start getting a bit of confidence in the way we play and you started winning, because, I mean, confidence comes from evidence at the end of the day. If you don't do it, it's very hard to be confident in something if you don't know you can do it. So from a team's point of view, that confidence just grew and grew and grew. And you saw, I mean, the levels in which the players were starting to elevate themselves too. And this goes for the whole team. I mean, Adil Rashid is a prime example of that. Again, probably it'd be fair in saying that it was a stuttering England career to start before. And then now he's one of the best leg spinners in the world. And he is the jewel in the crown, really. He really is just an incredible talent, but also an asset to our side. And yeah, so I think the development of players like that, the squad of players, it really did change. It's changed English cricket for the better, really, because you now see the knock-on effects of all the young players, all the English young players in terms of white ball. I think we've got as much depth as, certainly from a batting point of view, as much depth as anywhere in the world. And we could probably pick three batting lineups that could easily play in international cricket and be successful consistently. I'm a wicket keeper, for goodness sake, and my List A record is pretty good, and it's just saying there's only one wicket keeping role. But I think that's just a prime example of where English cricket's at the moment. I mean, keepers wise, we could pick a top seven, and it would be just as good as anywhere.
Yeah, I was going to say your first class record is very good as well, but we've got millions of keepers.
It's getting better. It's getting better, my first class record. My List A is definitely my strongest. Yeah. I'm playing next week. Yeah, I mean, the last 3.5 months, I've played one game, got injured and didn't play again. So, so yeah, I just want to play cricket. I'm hitting the ball as well as I have done in a very long time. So working with Ponting, I definitely feel as if I've progressed. And just want to get out there and put it into place now and get some runs.
Not a bad man to work with. Something that I've always been fascinated is the wrong word, definitely the wrong word, but something I've always been interested in was the England Lions tour to South Africa that preceded that summer. Yeah. So the squad you had was ridiculous, and I don't think listeners will know this. So just to reel off a few names, you had Stokes, Roy, Vince, Plunkett, Bairstow, yourself, Rashid, Wood. Loads of other brilliant cricketers. And in that series, England scored 370 twice. Did that series almost give you confidence in the method that you then showed you could do at international level afterwards? Because that was against a good South Africa attack as well. I think Chris Morris was playing. I think Rabada played a couple of those games. It was a seriously good South Africa team, seriously good series. Do you think that series gave you confidence in the method later on that year?
I think so, but also growing up with most of those guys together. And like you said, that's where the Lions tours and things like that really have a huge impact, I suppose. Most listeners wouldn't know that, but actually that's where, we don't all just turn up in international cricket and start playing and whacking it all over the place. I mean, that's the kind of environments where you've got to start learning and against top quality opposition. The Lions tours were invaluable for all of us. And like you said, it was just building that confidence and having that clarity of, okay, right, we're going to take this on, and having the players there that naturally play that way translated straight away. And I think the team kind of chemistry element, going straight from the Lions and then going into that international environment, definitely helps as well. Mm. It helps ease that process. People feel a lot more comfortable making that step up.
How does team chemistry impact how you bat? Because a lot of people talk about cricket as a sport where it's a team sport, but lots of individual battles. So how does the chemistry you have with your teammates impact performance?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think team chemistry is important. I think even more so over the last 2 years, because the amount of time we've spent away from home, the schedules and everything like that. And actually, we've got a great group of human beings who don't cause many issues for each other. And you see that translate, I suppose, with a lot of teams, issues come, you see the results on the pitch with the issues behind the scenes. And actually, when it's happy camp off the, I'm not saying like a happy team and a really nice team that get on really well are going to win. They're not. But it definitely is something that helps a team, because actually people are genuinely happy for other people's success. Yes, there was healthy competition, but actually being happy for each other was something that I don't think necessarily in previous, I don't know this, but in previous England dressing rooms, that might have been an issue, and as has been reported way before my time. But I think it definitely does help, because having a strong leader, kind of expecting high levels of kind of as a human being, as a not only as a cricketer, I think it's really important. It's a really complex question, I suppose, and some people sit there and go, no, just pick the 11 best cricketers. Yeah, but there's no reason why your 11 best cricketers can't be decent blokes and also build towards the team. The team element's a massive one, and that's why the success has been how it is. I mean, the example that springs to mind is when Mallow got that 100 and in New Zealand, and Morgs pulled him aside as was reported and just said, like, we don't do that in this team kind of thing. Every run counts, as the World Cup showed. It is. And it's a really, it's a really interesting example and a really poignant example, because it is true that actually everything should be geared towards the team. I suppose that's just an example that's definitely helped everyone and realize, okay, yeah, this is still what we expect of each other.
That's really interesting. That's really interesting. So
I'm not slating anyone off there.
No, absolutely.
That's a really healthy example that actually the World Cup that a couple of years ago shows that everyone counts, and people talk about the cliche fielding, everyone counts in there, and you've got to be. It's true. Like, these small margins, it won't happen every game, but actually that one game, and funnily enough, it's the biggest game when it's the final, that's when it matters. Mm. It's not, if you do these things consistently over time, you will get better and better. And actually in those close games, you'll end up on the right side of them as it's shown. And I think that's, again, credit to Morgs really for driving that home and keeping consistent and authentic with that.
Mm. And then when you talked a lot about when you had that New Zealand series, a lot of the kind of Owen Morgan was very good at making you guys feel like you could play your natural games. Were there any instructions like that in that Lions tour when you guys were scoring 370? Or was it just a case of guys were playing their natural games and it was literally as simple as that?
Yeah, I'm sure it was talked about. I can't remember, if I'm honest, but I think the thing that struck me was that Andy Flower and Thorpey, who were coaches of that Lions team, really drove home that we've been picked based on how we've gone about our business in county cricket and also performance wise. So just play that. Just, you don't have to turn up to the lines. I think in the past you've kind of turned up and gone, right, I've got to be the perfect player and I've got to play a way that certain other people want me to play, or you think that's the case when it's not. So I think there would have been conversations around that. I can't remember exactly, but I think that's a positive thing, that there was definitely no conversation saying, don't do this, don't do that. It was completely the opposite. It's very encouraging and very supportive in the way we wanted to go about it. And I think it maybe actually showed a lot of people that where we could get to as well. Going, right, geez, where can we take this? A kind of curiosity element, as opposed to, this is the way we've always played and moving the game on.
Mm. And then finally, you may well not remember this, but I'm going to ask anyway. In that final ODI of the series, the one where you and Bairstow put on that partnership, New Zealand ended up picking a guy essentially plucked from club cricket who happened to be in the country at the time. He had a decent domestic record in New Zealand, but his name was Andrew Matheson. He barely played a professional game after that tour. Did you know that happened at the time? Do you remember what conversations were like in the England dressing room? Because I imagine there's lots of all the preparation and analysis of the opposition goes on nowadays, at least.
Really? I don't remember that at all. I remember the name, but geez, I don't remember that at all.
So he was a professional cricketer. So yeah, let me just clarify. He was a professional cricketer who had done quite well in the List A comp in New Zealand the year before that. He wasn't in the New Zealand squad. He was playing club cricket in Devon for Sidmouth CC around about that time. And I think there was a couple of injuries and he ended up playing. And I think, I might have got this wrong, but Craig Overton, I think, was added to the squad. I don't think he played, but he was added to the squad. And Craig was actually set to play against him in a club game. And they nearly played against each other in an ODI game. It didn't quite happen, but it was very close. And because you hear these stories from like years and years ago, but that happened 6 years ago.
Oh,
no recollection at all. Like, you guys weren't really aware of that.
No, I do, but I just, I can't. I think we were all so focused on actually just trying to win the game and win the series. And I think it was just the excitement. I remember, like, I've got an invite. We all got invited, the New Zealand team and ourselves, and only three of us rocked up. But on the way up from Trent Bridge was the fourth one to Durham, which is the last one. On the way up, we got invited to Botham's house for a barbecue. Oh, just like, I checked my phone. I'm like, sorry? And like, I'm like, this is all new to me. I was just like, what is going on? Call my dad up and I go, I've just got a text from management saying we've got a barbecue at Ian Botham's. Like, it's optional, but I'm going. He said, absolutely you're going. Anyway, only three of us turned up. Stephen Finn, myself and Morgie, and then the rest of the New Zealand team. But I just thought, and I'm a bit of a badger, I don't mind admitting that, but I was just thinking, so Ian Botham's just invited me us around his house for a barbecue and whatever. Like, why wouldn't you say yes? I mean, so it was just stuff like that. I think it was just, we're all running on the excitement and too busy to notice everything else that was going on. So it was pretty, pretty cool.
Is that a regular thing? Mid-series barbecues at Beefy's?
No, I can't have made an impression because I haven't been invited back. So it was amazing. But that's the thing, isn't it? You don't get invited to things like that. Pretty cool. So
yeah,
it was a good feeling. Glass of wine and away we went. So
amazing. Yeah, off to bar. I think that's an apt place to end the chat, Sam. Much appreciated. Hope the rest of quarantine isn't too taxing for you, and better luck with the start of the season.
Brilliant, thanks, mate.
So yeah, that series saw Roy, Stokes, Billings and Rashid either introduced or brought back into the fold. It really was the start of the 2019 World Cup journey, wasn't it?
It was. And I don't even remember, I spoke to Owen Morgan, which we featured on this podcast. I can't remember if this bit of it featured it or not, but I asked him if actually it was a blessing that that World Cup went quite as badly as it did, because it did give him the opportunity to have a completely clean slate. And he said, if we'd scraped through to the quarterfinals, everyone might have said, well, we didn't do that well, but you know, we could have done a little bit better if things had gone our way. With that World Cup, there was no question about it. They were terrible. They were playing the wrong form of cricket. And things had to change, and Paul Downton left. Morgan name-checked that and said that gave him the freedom, with Strauss coming in, someone he knew well, former teammate of his, a renewed focus on one-day cricket. I'm loathe to criticise Peter Moores too much, because I think he's got a rough deal from English cricket, but I think you also have to acknowledge that Bayliss, or Farbrace at this point, was a sort of coach that gave Morgan freedom to do what he wanted and to stamp his own mark on the side. And that's absolutely what he did. And it is true that the personnel obviously changed, but Billings was the only England debutant in that New Zealand ODI series. So it's a little bit of a myth that the whole thing changed in terms of personnel, which makes it all the more incredible the results and the way they played changed so quickly, because a lot of those players, six of the team who played at Edgbaston in that first ODI, had been part of the World Cup squad. Butler had played in that World Cup, couldn't be himself, and then plays the innings really that kicks it all off at Edgbaston, hitting that 100. And from then on, it absolutely set the path and gave them the confidence to follow that over the next 4 years, with Morgan leading from the front.
New Zealand are also almost the perfect opponent as well. You know, you had Brendan McCullum, who's, you know, back in those days was a complete sort of breath of fresh air in terms of being an international cricket captain. Always spoke very well, always talked about sort of like the game being the game itself being more important than the individuals playing it, and wanting to entertain and do all of these things. And so you had this idea of two teams who were going to play completely, you know, free and easy cricket against one another. Might not have happened if it had been in Australia and there'd been more pressure, maybe. I don't know. And one team, you know, the teams had not kind of complemented each other so beautifully in terms of just going toe to toe and just, you know, Hearn's Hagler swinging each other for the five matches. It might not have come about. But, you know, I think the point about there not being that many players, you know, only the one player making a debut in the series is an important one. Because what it did show you was that the change of personnel, or at least the change of outlook from the personnel, did as much to change around the results as, you know, a completely new broom coming in and just picking extra or different players from county cricket. That wasn't what happened. They picked players that they'd had in there already, had already identified as being good enough or explosive enough to play, but then sort of shackled them in the way that they were asked to go about it. Whereas Morgan came in and went, well, you know, you guys are incredible. Incredible ball strikers, blokes who can take wickets in the middle periods of innings. We're just going to go in there and play to all of your strengths rather than trying to conform to some strange idea of what 50 over cricket used to look like.
I think it's quite interesting that Billing says that they never mentioned the World Cup once in that series, but also I get your point that the personnel was by and large there. Ben Stokes had played a fair bit of ODI cricket before that World Cup. They didn't take him because they were using him as a bowling all-rounder who batted at eight, and then on that Lions tour he got one huge score. England Lions scored 370 a couple of times, and I think it's more just kind of letting the guys play their natural games and feeling that they could do that without, you know, I put it to Billings that it's quite hard to bat a number seven in white ball cricket, especially if you're a specialist number seven, and you've kind of got to feel like, you know, you can bat as aggressively as batting number seven should allow you to be, which I thought was quite interesting.
I thought also, and Billings kind of alludes to this, that the personal milestones really ceased to mean much at all. And this that reminded me of speaking to Jason Roy, I think at the start of 2019, maybe 2018, about, because I think at that point he had just beaten what had been Robin Smith's record for the highest ODI score by an England batsman, which Alex Hales had passed, and then Roy had beaten that. And Roy kind of barely really understood. Well, he knew he'd done something, but didn't really know exactly what record was. There'd been no real recognition of it in the changing room because that wasn't the important thing. And I think Roy, a couple of years earlier, had had the chance here actually at the Oval against Sri Lanka. I think he was about five within Smith's record, had 12 overs to go, so could have just knocked it around for an over and had got there. He had no idea that record existed, didn't care about it. It wasn't what the team focus was on. And I think that's been so important to the way that England play, because players don't slow down when they get into the 80s and 90s. If anything, they go quicker.
To show that they don't care.
Well, I think there is an element of that. There is that showiness. And I think Ben Stokes does that a lot. There is a showiness that it's for the team rather than the individual, which actually serves a purpose in itself, because it kind of shows up anyone who's not doing that. And look, we know an incident which Billings referred to of David Milan, who fell foul of that and has probably got more stick than he deserved, because it is so anti what Morgan's ethos is all about. But I think that's hugely important, that it's team totals, it's not individual
totals.
And
it works both ways too, because the other side of it, again, that Sam sort of alluded to, which is no recriminations. You don't get slated walking back in the dressing room for holding out a long off or deep mid wicket first ball or whenever it might be. You do not find your approach or your dismissal counting against you in the dressing room, because as long as you're taking a positive option, one that is going to score maximum amount of runs in terms of the team total, you're not going to go back in there and find yourself being hauled over the coals for a sort of slight misjudgment in terms of your thinking. I've played in teams where that's the case, and it's unbelievably liberating. It's bloody dangerous for the opposition. It's actually quite dangerous for you from time to time, because you can get bowled out for 60 doing it. But you know what I mean? You get bowled out for 60 and the captain comes in and goes, oh, well, come on, let's go and have a drink. Yeah, we'll do it again tomorrow. And you get 500 the next, you know what I mean?
Which, to be honest, happened quite a lot with that England side.
If you're playing with that level of risk, you're gonna collapse every once in a while.
Your Surrey skipper, Adam Holyoake, was sort of a prototype for what we're talking about,
entirely,
right?
Entirely, that's exactly what I'm talking. He is exactly what I'm talking about. We're not worried. It's not a problem. Alistair Brown, if you think you can get 200 today, try and get him in 30 overs. You know, that sort of nonsense. But it's, in theory, it's not going to work every day. But what it does do is it gives everybody the sort of like, there's no stress. You know what I mean? It takes away the idea that you're likely to lose your place if you make a daft call. People do lose their places. Yeah, of course they do. They're lack of form or whatever. But the ethos running through the 11 players is that you do this two or three times in a row in the midst of a series like this, it's not going to count against you. What would count against you is if you going into your shell and playing for your own numbers. And us losing anyway. That's what will count against you. And it's very liberating.
It's also sort of stating the obvious, but you've got to have the players to be able to play like that. It's no good saying, right, we're all going to go out and play our shots if you're not good enough.
No, exactly.
And Surrey had it.
But isn't that entirely the point? You know, you kind of... The captain, Owen Morgan, says, right, well, I want Ben Stokes in my team, but he's not batting eight. He's going to bat three, or wherever he's been batting for Durham. We're going to give people the chance to show what they can do. Not based around. Well, so and so should be batting at number four in this team. We're going to put you somewhere where you can create the most havoc, where your abilities can cause the most damage to the opposition. And so on that score, yes, the selectors have to identify the right players. But I think we've already established that they had done. They'd already identified them. They just hadn't put them in the right positions and given them the license to go and do what it was that they did best. It's almost like, you get selected and the reason that you've been picked goes out the window. We want you to conform to this other way of playing, this safe way of playing. And that's where his messaging is so strong and continues to be so strong in the England scene.
I guess it helped as well that it was a five-match series from that point of view. Like, if it's a three-match series, it's almost a bit harder to... You can basically back that top seven to say, go out and play a natural game, and they might think to themselves, okay, well, if I do that, hopefully it'll come off one time out of five, and they've seen what I can do. Whereas if it's a bit shorter...
Well, then you say that. I mean, again, we're talking right at the very beginning of the journey, but they kind of, it came off for them in the first. They continued to do it right the way through. There weren't very many setbacks, but, that I can still remember rumblings. Oh, my goodness, they're going to go out there and slog from ball one again. They only needed 150 and lost, that type of thing. But Morgan never changed his mind. And so by the time they got through to tournament play, which I think the point you're making, the three-match series... that feels like it's very short and you haven't got much room for error. But knockout matches, there is no room for error. And England still did the same thing. And it was the only thing that changed things for England in that World Cup was conditions. Suddenly, England, having played wherever they played for the four-year cycle going onwards, where the pitches were all belters and the ball was disappearing out the park, we suddenly found ourselves on all these, you know, 240 plays, 240 decks at home. And that wasn't the case. You know, that wasn't because they tightened up. That was because nobody could score more than 240 on the decks that were being provided for the World Cup.
I think as well that that New Zealand series was really important in getting the media on side as well, because that that is in players' minds a lot of the time, and a lot of them will admit it after the fact that you've got to feel like you can go out there. And it's the same, the lack of recriminations from the dressing room. There was also got to a point where people got behind what Morgan was trying to do, partly because the World Cup had been so pathetic that players did have that freedom. And I think all of us as journalists or pundits or ex-players were like, great, we're ready for something new. Please give us something new. We can't have this same old...
But also, it's fun to watch. Even when it goes wrong, it's fun to watch. You know, if it goes wrong, the game's over in 25 overs. You can write your copy and go and do something else with your day. You know what I mean? 50-over cricket was on its knees in this country up until that point. You know, people were genuinely saying, why do we bother with this format anymore? You know, 20-over cricket's fine. Why waste 8.5, 9 hours of your day watching this? It's terrible. And then suddenly it wasn't terrible anymore.
That concept that you not batting your 50 overs was considered absolutely criminal. That was just the worst thing you could do in 50-over cricket. And suddenly Morgan was like, well, hang on, what's the point? If we can get to a higher total in quicker time rather than just batting until for the sake of it, then what is the point? And completely turned that on its head. And they did get bowled out quite a lot, having already got past, what, 330, 350?
Yeah, I remember that first game where there were 220 for 200 odd for six, and then getting 400, just being in total awe, like how have England done this? Like any old team, you know, any team getting 400 is amazing, but how have England, like, two games after World Cup done it? Yeah, that was amazing.
Yeah, and just the narrative of it being New Zealand was just so perfect, because we talked about the thrashings in the World Cup. New Zealand was the worst of them. When Saudi took 7 for, and then McCullum hit, I think, a 29 ball 77. And so while Morgan maybe needed the Bangladesh result to go against England to sort of get everyone else on his side, I think he's on record as saying that's the game, that New Zealand game was when he realised that it kind of needed to change, because he saw how New Zealand played and just totally destroyed England. So for that then to be their first opponents, and England to then go toe-to-toe with them, actually come out on top playing in that exact fashion, and then to beat them in the World Cup final, 4 years later, which is all so perfect, basically.
Anyway, that's all we've got time for in the show.
Hey, what about my moment of the week?
Oh, sorry, what's your moment of the week?
I mean, crying out loud, it's the only reason I turn up. No, it's going to be Mark Stoneman getting 100.
Yes.
Return to form, really nice piece by Will McPherson in The Standard about his son's heart condition, which has kind of had a major effect on him and on his thinking now, but also during the time where he's been in the doldrums for the last 3 years after being left out of the England side. And the reason that it struck me was because of the conversation we had last week about Graham Gooch and the kind of like him being able to use the peripherals, you know, the bad stuff happening in on the outside of cricket as a spur. And Mark Stoneman sort of goes into great length about how he found it impossible to kind of compartmentalise what was going on in his home life and still be successful as a batsman and a cricketer. So I just felt like it was kind of a nice little follow-on from something that we'd already mentioned. Mm. We Absolutely. Don't just throw this stuff together, you know.
Absolutely.
It's a brilliant interview, that. I mean, he has a really good way of describing how it affected his cricket. He said it was like a computer where you've got lots of programmes running, and even if they're in the background, it sort of takes up the processing power. So that main program, which you're trying to use at that time, is running that little bit slower, which I thought was a very eloquent way of putting it. I think it's just a lesson to us journalists to kind of, you know, you never know what's going on in someone's personal life at the time. It's very easy to look at, you know, Mark Stoneman doing okay in the Ashes and then coming back and struggling in county cricket afterwards and being like, oh, it's that traditional thing of a cricketer who's, you know, had a taste at the top level and then is all of a sudden the pressure's on and then they can't do it. And there's like so much more to it that's... We've just got to keep in mind the possibility that there's something that you don't know about, I guess. And yeah, it's a credit to him for speaking out, and well done for Will for writing
and
it.
And it's a really, really good interview. You can find that on the Evening Standard website or in the paper itself. I think that is it for the show, though. That is it, unless anyone else wants to get anything in there. No, all good. Cheers, Joe. Cheers, Butch. Cheers, Ben. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. If you enjoyed the show, hit the like button, hit the subscribe button, and we'll be back next week. Cheers.